or something that would kind of enhance our academic kind of bona fides here. But again, I think given the era that we're in, it makes sense to probably talk about really the first paper that formally got put into print this past month on the pathology of COVID-19 out of the Wuhan province. So I'm sure everybody has heard of this article by Tian and colleagues, again, out of Wuhan, out of the province in China where this pandemic first began. This was the first paper that documented the pathologic findings that were seen in a couple of early patients. It's a small series consisting of two patients, and their objective was to offer that first pathologic description of COVID-19-associated pneumonia, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus, as well as to clarify that the finding may be serendipitously found or discovered in specimens taken for other reasons. Namely, at least in these two patients, those specimens were taken for cancer and then later found to harbor this pneumonia. So it's a relatively simple, straightforward report of two cases. Again, it came out with quite a bit of media attention in February of this year, right after the onset of the pandemic in early January. The first case was an 84-year-old woman who was evaluated to treat a 1.5-centimeter lung mass found in her right middle lobe. There were some bilateral ground glass opacities noted during her first week of admission, but the significance of it wasn't determined. She spent actually a pretty long period in the hospital as an inpatient before they actually underwent resection, and the details of that were not elaborated on in the paper, unfortunately. But in any case, she was admitted on day one, and then the lobectomy happened on day 12, so she was there nearly 2 weeks with these kind of mild ground glass opacities, but apparently no respiratory symptoms. She underwent lobectomy, and then on post-op day 4, she began developing dyspnea and dry cough that were suggestive of a viral pneumonia. So suggestive from a clinical standpoint, in fact, that they went back and reevaluated the lobectomy specimen that was taken from her 4 days prior. And started to look at that. Despite aggressive therapy, she ended up succumbing to the disease a couple weeks after that. And then some extensive contact tracing revealed that she had been exposed to the novel coronavirus from a patient from a roommate that she was with in the hospital there. The second case was a 73-year-old man who underwent lobectomy for a mass as well. On post-op day 2, he developed ground glass opacities that was then followed by some fever and a dry cough on day 9. He was readmitted and recovered and discharged 20 days later without sequela being mentioned. The pathology were similar in both of these cases. The lobectomy specimens obviously showed the adenocarcinomas they were looking for, but away from the tumors, they noted alveolar septal edema, proteinaceous exudates with prominent spherical secretions or concretions within the air spaces. They also noted intraalveolar fibrin and some giant cells seen. Pneumocyte hyperplasia was noted in both cases. And on one of the cases, specifically the first case, they noted some things that they thought were viral inclusions. And if you have the executive summary pulled up, I pulled one of the images there with an arrow in the lower right-hand corner of the first image there that points to a viral inclusion. Personally, I think it's a bit dubious. I think it kind of looks like a kind of a random bizarre cell. I think it's not definitively a viral inclusion by any means, but nevertheless, they were worried about it enough to call it out. They didn't note any such viral inclusions in the second case, and they did note that this viral inclusion was a pretty rare finding in the first case with really only a couple identified.
Is it just me, or does that inclusion look like a cytoplasmic intranuclear pseudo-inclusion? That's what
looks Yeah, I agree. It looks like a little artifact of processing, really. It just
and their globules are not. I mean, those are just corporate amelia.
They're just corporate. I agree. Yeah, they're just corporate amelia.
Okay.
They don't look like anything special. Yeah,
okay.
Clearly they're kind of doing a little bit of reaching here on both of those fronts. Finding things that are abnormal that probably aren't as abnormal as they think and attributing them to possibly these findings, which I think is inappropriate. The acute lung injury findings they're seeing, I mean, obviously those are probably real. Some of the type 2 pneumocyte hyperplasia they're seeing, the intraalveolar fibrin and some of that stuff, sure. I mean, that's probably, you know, reasonable. That may be explaining the GGOs, certainly. That's the airspace filling stuff, as well as maybe some of the proteinaceous exudate. But I mean, the issue here, of course, is the earliness of these findings. None of their cases had any hyaline membranes or, you know, the findings of DAD that have been subsequently reported in a number of publications now. And that's probably owing to the fact that, again, they were really stretching here to get this thing pushed out and to describe these early findings, which again, probably don't have more of the hallmarks that we've come to recognize in this particular condition at this point. So largely these could be considered from asymptomatic individuals. Both of them were asymptomatic, and so they probably just represent early descriptions of some possible findings that I think most of us would have likely predicted just given what we know about other cases of viral pneumonias. So a lot of kind of non-specific stuff here, not a ton of really great take-home points or a lot for us to consider other than the fact that, yep, this disease does have an asymptomatic phase, and some people it's asymptomatic throughout its course entirely for reasons that are not clear. You may see these things incidentally in the course of looking for other things. Some of that's a little bit less now with a lot of hospitals doing routine COVID screening before they even take patients to the OR. I don't know how everybody else's hospital's working, but certainly that's really in full effect here at Mayo. The patients really need to demonstrate, I think it's now 2 negative PCR tests before they're taking them to the OR for more elective type surgery like this. So, you know, taking a patient to the OR that has COVID unbeknownst to everybody is a more uncommon phenomenon now, unless it's an urgent situation. Any questions or comments on that?
You know, just one comment. This is Andras. I think there have been a couple other papers, one in Modern Pathology, the other one, not sure, American Journal of Clinical Pathology. In the American Journal of Clinical Pathology, Sanjay was the senior author, and then the other one came from Wuhan.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. So we'll move on to the next article. This is by Nerutz et al., Prognostic Value and Therapeutic Implications of Expanded Molecular Testing for Resected Early-Stage Lung Adenocarcinomas. So their purpose here was to evaluate the evolution of molecular testing with regards to detection rates and expanding prognostic and potential therapeutic implications. So basically, they were looking at a time frame over which molecular testing for lung adenocarcinoma had improved and changed, namely from 2011 to 2017. And looking at what those changes in the molecular panels that were being done at that time and how extensively they were evaluating these genes had done both for identifying underlying mutation or mutations in many of these cancers, as well as assessing the prognostic significance of what they uncovered by virtue of that expanded molecular testing. So their other aim was to assess the additive value of expanded molecular testing and identifying treatment targets and distinguishing independent primaries of resected lung adenocarcinoma. I'll point out later that they really didn't hit some of these aims very well in the end for a variety of reasons. And then to determine the association of detected mutations with disease recurrence and survival. So they did a retrospective analysis of patients that underwent lobectomy and mediastinal lymphadenectomy for stage 1 and 2 lung adenocarcinomas between 2011 and 2017. They ensured that the cases that they were evaluating had pretty uniform treatment strategies after diagnosis. Obviously, there was that was somewhat time specific. They had to compare within times because the treatments obviously changed somewhat substantially over the course of the 6 years, as did the molecular testing, of course. And the way that their molecular testing was done between 2011 and 2013, these were relatively limited panels that were done, consisting of ELK fish Sanger sequencing for KRAS exon 2, looking for EGFR 19 exon 19 indels, and looking for the L858R mutation, as well as the T790M. For the next couple of years, the second third of their cohort, that expanded to basically include a 20-gene panel. And then that 20-gene panel expanded to a 50-gene panel between the years 2015 and 2017 that they analyzed. And this largely parallels, I think, most of the practice that we all saw happen over those years as well. Limited number of genes that then expanded to include a 50-gene panel that's pretty routine even today, a few years later. So there was a lot of progress made, and then it slowed down a little bit, you know, Moore's Law and all. Patients followed with surveillance visits every 3 to 6 months for 3 years, and then annually, and then they calculated the disease-free and overall survivals. 324 patients were included in this, mean age of about 65 years, mostly white women. Most recurrent or former smokers. Two-thirds of their patients ended up having a stage 1 or stage 2 disease at the end of everything, after they assessed for, you know, the pathologic stage, after they compared the pathologic staging to the clinical staging. Their inclusion criteria were based on the clinical staging. KRAS exon 2 was the most frequent harbored mutation that they uncovered, present in about just a little over a third of their cases. EGFR in 18%, and most of these were the exon 19 indels or L858R. Total mutations increased across the three time periods, which obviously would be expected with the expansion of the panels that they were using. And so this actually went from identifying about a mutation in about half of the cases in their initial cohort, to 86% in the expanded 20-gene profile, and then that rose to slightly more than 90% in the 50-gene panel. And importantly, from in addition to just identifying mutations for identification's sake and understanding, they also looked at which of these mutations were actionable or theranostic, and those improved as well. And again, this justifies those expanded panels from a clinical standpoint. And those increased from 18 to 32 to ultimately 45 in the 50-gene panel. So again, provides ample rationale for evaluating for these genes, given the better resolution it gives you on the molecular drivers in the tumor. Yeah.
Could I ask, did they have any data on how many patients were treated based on these results?
So yes and no. And this is where it gets really sticky. So I was really excited when I started reading this. I'm like, oh, finally, this is going to give us some good information on treatment and overall outcomes, because they had said right at the beginning that they were going to be looking at DFS and OS in these patients. And I thought, all right, we're going to finally have some good data to show that what we're getting is, you know, not only theoretical bang for our buck, but actually improves survival and actually does improve the targeted therapy that we can give. Unfortunately, they get all the way to the end, and I'm like, wait a minute, they didn't even really cover that part of it. And there's one line in their discussion that basically talks about the fact that because the latter ones, because their analysis basically happened so close to 2017 here, they didn't have enough time elapsed to do direct comparators with the older cohorts. So they basically didn't give themselves enough lag time to actually – they were in too much of a hurry, I think, to get this out for whatever reason. And they weren't able to do the type of analysis that they kind of originally intended on doing, given what they laid out in their introduction. So
that's helpful. I was just wondering, even apart from survival, they found something that they could use to treat – but it was in a population of patients that mostly were unlikely to need treatment at least in the immediate postoperative period. So we don't know how many actually got anything.
That's exactly right. These were early stage diseases, and so they were pre-selected for that. You're exactly right.
Okay.
So the analysis that they did do with survival showed that KRAS and BRAF mutations fared worse. That we know that comports pretty well with the literature that's already out there. And then they go on again to say that the prognostic improvement really couldn't be appropriately evaluated and compared between the cohorts because of the fact that they didn't have sufficient follow-up really in that latter cohort. So I thought that was a real missed opportunity in this particular paper that I was a little bit sad to see because I was really hoping for a little bit more meat on the bones in that area. I was kind of excited about this article specifically for that reason. I mean, I like the data that they presented in terms of showing that they were able to, nicely pick up more mutations and that they indeed were at least theoretically theranostic and they were, they had intention in terms of why they were detecting these things, but then kind of the follow-up data lacking kind of made the whole paper lacking, I think, in that area really left me wanting more. So the take-home points here are expanded panels have definitely improved our ability to detect mutations or multiple mutations, including driver mutations that may be potentially targetable. What significance or impact that has on patient survival or their prognosis has not yet been determined by this, but maybe they'll produce a follow-up later on that kind of aims at that or gets at that a little bit better. Thoughts? Comments? Other than just astute observation? All right, we'll move on to the third paper. This third paper was a little bit more complicated, I think, than it really needed to be. The reading it was a little bit it was a lot of work at times. I think it read a bit like stereo instructions. It wasn't really easy to get through.
Have you ever read a stereo instruction?
Only about a paragraph. That's all I can ever get into. that's kind of the point there, right? Like it's, you get about a paragraph in and you're like, where are we going with this? This is not what I wanted. I just wanted to listen to the music, man. Like this is too complicated. So this is by Tunison and colleagues, programmed death ligand 1 expression influenced by tissue sample size, scoring based on tissue microarrays cross-validations with resections in patients with stage 1 through 3 non-small cell lung cancer from the European Thoracic Oncology Platform Lungscape cohort. This was published in Modern Path, and they set out to demonstrate the effect of harmonization of PD-L1 scoring on tissue microarrays by an external quality assessment program. And then they also, their second aim was to examine the heterogeneity by comparing extent of staining across different microarray cores as mimickers of biopsy with comparison to whole slide mounts of the tumor itself. So taking kind of small pieces that mimicked or emulated biopsies and seeing how well those correlated with the ultimate whole slide mounts PD-L1 interpretation in between pathologists. So lots of, it turns out, even though it sounded kind of simple at the beginning, the way that they designed their analysis and kind of the crosswalk statistically between all these cohorts got really convoluted really, really quickly. What they did is they did a retrospective analysis. So they pulled all these patients with stage 1 through 3 non-small cell lung cancer from the various centers that are included in this European Thoracic Oncology Lungscape platform. And once they polled all those, they also gathered up a bunch of pathologists from these institutions. 14 of the 15 actually contributed pathologists to look at these things. And they put them all through a two-day live training session, a face-to-face training session, where they basically took them through a boot camp of how to score PD-L1 and how to do it reliably for themselves and how to do it, interreliable with each other. And at the end of that two-day training period, they were able to demonstrate a greater than 90% concordance between the trainer and the pathologist, as well as between the pathologists themselves who underwent the training. They used, for the training set, cell lines and microarray cores from some of the retrospective cases that they pulled from the various institutions to make sure that they didn't have bias from one place over another. They then had kind of a three-month washout period where they sent the pathologist away and said, okay, go about your practice. And then after that 3 months elapsed, they sent them all these sets that they were going to read and score. And these sets basically consisted of these cores that were taken from all the different institutions' archives of these stage one to three cancers. They asked them to score the percent of the tumor cell membranes, as well as the overall score in the increments that I've outlined on the sheet here, basically less than 1%, 1 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 25, 25 to 50, and greater than 25. Three different expression cutoffs were used, 1, 50, and 25, and they really were paying special minds to 1 in 50 because they thought that's where the most reliability would be. The cross-validation between the cores and the sections, the whole sections, was performed in 10% of randomly of these samples randomly, and so they basically took all the cases that they pulled from all these centers and took randomly 10% of them spread across all the centers and decided to do the crosswalks between the cores and the whole mounts to do that small biopsy, in quotes, their comparator. In the end, this amounted to a little over 2,400 cases from the 15 centers. Nearly 2,200 had PD-L1. When the primary investigator sat down and looked at these, they deemed that 174 of these were not evaluable and excluded for a variety of reasons. And so the final cohort included 2008 in the end. That was what they considered cohort one. That's what basically cohort one is where all the tissue microarray data came from. 237 whole sections were available in 237, accounting for 237 cases for cohort two. So that's about our 10% of random cases. The first round concordance on the QA tool after the three-month washout was 73%, so it had certainly dropped from their greater than 90% cohort. Interestingly, there was a bit of a rebound phenomenon that happened 3 months after that first washout period where the concordance what the people got between all these microarray cores kind of came up back to about 80% or so. Concordance cases at 1, 25, and 50 were 85, 91, and 93, respectively. So basically, when you kind of get to that 50%, most pathologists can say, like, yeah, there's more than half or less than half here, and that concordance rate drops a little bit, although not a whole lot, at those lower thresholds. Tissue microarray core results were considered identical for 70% of cases. So actually, again, not terrible concordance, better than I would have predicted, actually, just based on, my own seeming inability to be consistent with myself on a lot of these PD-L1 reads. Sensitivity of the tissue microarray method for 125 and 50 was 80, 78, and 79, respectively, and that equated to a specificity of 90, 95, and 98. That 50% cutoff seems to be a pretty good sweet spot for pathologists being able to distinguish whether there's more or less than half of the cells staining and the intensities as well. When comparing microarray and whole sections, complete agreement was seen in 60%, and that usually resulted from an underestimation by the small cores. So we'll get to that in just one second here. And higher sensitivity rates were observed for the 1% and the 50% more so than the other ones. And so they had initially hypothesized that pathologists would be able to kind of see that yeah, about 1% of the cells are staining, that there'd be less reproducibility around some of like the 5 to 10 and 10 to 25s and stuff like that. And then 50% would be another big giant cutoff. And indeed, that did appear to pan out based on their data. So what they expect us to walk away from this are that there is an underestimation of PD-L1 expression that can be seen, and it's more commonly seen on small biopsies than overestimation. And that I think makes sense. And so certainly you're not going to call a small biopsy or, you know, a small piece of a tumor 90% staining typically, and then have that just have fortuitously hit a real hot spot in the whole mount tumor or the tumor overall. And so that underestimation will be more common. And I think that makes sense. That comports with what you'd think going into this. Classification of PD-L1 on small biopsy samples does not represent overall expression of PD-L1 in these cases, even though the majority of them would be classified correctly, especially using those cutoffs of 1 in 50%. When you use those, most of these things end up being concordant, even when you compare them to the bigger resections. Sampling more and larger biopsies obviously will increase predictive accuracy of these, and I think we would have all predicted that going in too, so that's not really earth-shattering from any sense. But I'd love to hear from other people and what their experiences with PD-L1 and inter-observer reliability and things like that have been at their institutions, because I think this is still an area that, you know, it's challenging. It's not easy. We see an awful lot here. You know, at our place here at Mayo, but, you know, it's still tough to make sure you're being consistent.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
This is Henry. I don't read these, but it makes me wonder whether anybody has, so, you know, one of the beauties of doing non-specialized pathology is you get to look at how other organ systems do things and other pathologists. So when you do breast pathology and you go to the MD Anderson residual breast carcinoma website, there are pictures for you to at least use as a guide,
yeah,
which I think helps you in figure out, okay, which does, you know, it really is matching the wallpaper, but has anybody done that for PD-L1, and wouldn't that, like, make some sense? I mean, you can only remember so far,
yeah,
what sort,
yeah,
of 30%
right,
looks like, even if you've been trained for 2 days, if you don't use it every day, and I suspect that's what's happened here partly, you're going to forget what that image kind of looks like. Why not have a fixed image and one that every, you know, mathematically figured,
Henry,
out?
Yep. Yeah.
Henry, this is Andras. I think the problem with that is that in the long, macrophage is also stained. So if you,
yep,
just see a wallpaper, you wouldn't know, you wouldn't be able to differentiate between tumor cells and macrophages, for example.
Yeah, and
so,
also,
okay,
it's not the intensity of staining. Any intensity is accepted as positive. So you've got to sometimes go on high power and try to keep that image in your brain when you go back up to zoom up to low power again. It's a really difficult thing to do, I think. Unless I think that's why in Calgary, only people who do it regularly are doing this.
Yeah, I think a couple of challenges that we noticed early on. Initially, the pulmonary group here in Rochester was doing all of these for all the organ systems. So we were basically the funnel point. We took from everyone. But what quickly became clear as, you know, the literature started growing on PD-L1 is that different organ systems started using different cutoffs, different criteria, different reporting, you know, where you're looking at the, you know, the cell percentage, there's like a CPS score, there's all these things that certain organ systems started developing and showing with rather limited data, nevertheless, still demonstrating some significance to these different scoring systems they were providing. It quickly spiraled out of control for us, and we simply couldn't keep up with all of the different organ systems and all the different reporting strategies that were being requested from the clinical teams. And so there was a necessity to really farm these out to the organ systems, because really those were the only places that housed the content expertise that was contemporary enough to give the clinicians what they were looking for in their patients. There are, Anya can probably speak to this far better than I, and so I certainly chime in here as well, Anya, but there are websites that do have kind of different staining patterns and different quantities and stuff for you to look at. And there are also validation sets or teaching sets or check sets that have gone around, and we've done those several times now here in Rochester. Anya, do you want to speak to those at all?
Well, what I know is, for instance, the CAP, they have a proficiency testing now, what they send out, and we use it at least for the pulmonary group and compare ourselves amongst each other. And I think DACO has a manual which has a few examples in there. But, you know, you can even take a course, but I don't know if they provide you afterwards with any examples that you can keep. I don't know that.
So yeah, good discussion on that. And PD-L1 is, you know, it's a new hot thing, so nobody's going to escape it, I guess. Henry, who's doing all the reading down there for you guys?
You are.
I think it's us. It's us.
I just wanted that to be.
I'm not
clear,
stupid,
though.
Joe. Somehow I dropped off my phone, gave up in the middle of that, so I missed part of that. But no, we send all of ours up to you.
Yeah. All right. So the last article for discussion by Thor, I'm not really sure how to pronounce it. It's French. So I don't think MC's on the line to help us out here. But it's entitled Phenotype and Outcome of Pulmonary Arterial Hypertension Patients Carrying a TBX4 Mutation. Of course, I had to include a pulmonary hypertension article, not only because there were two really good ones this last month, but I thought this one was pretty cool because it really set out to look at a newer gene that's been described in pulmonary arterial hypertension. The big one in the past has always been the bone morphogenetic protein receptor 2, BMPR2, in PAH. That's been kind of the one that's most touted in the literature. But TBX4 has been coming on pretty strong, particularly in children. And so it was neat for to see an article that really was targeted at looking at those patients that carry a TBX4 mutation and putting it all together from a clinical, a radiologic, a hemodynamic, and a pathologic standpoint, and rolling all those together. So that's what this article basically did. It was a retrospective population-based query of the French Pulmonary Hypertension Network, looking for all these pulmonary arterial hypertension patients that harbor a TBX4 mutation. They pulled all their cases that basically had genetic screening. They looked for a series of about 9 genes that are all kind of outlined there on the summary. And then again, they took all the data that I mentioned before, clinical, functional, hemodynamic, radiologic, and pathologic information, and they basically synthesized those all together. In the end, they ended up looking at 448 patients in the index, and in that, they were able to identify 20 of pulmonary arterial hypertension patients in 17 unrelated families that had an underlying TBX4 mutation. This equated to about 6% of childhood PAH and 3% of adult PAH. And so when you consider that only about 15% of cases of pulmonary arterial hypertension have unidentifiable mutation with most of current generation assays, this is a pretty significant proportion. This gene is a big actor in that regard. They uncovered 11 known mutations, 2 copy number variants, and 1 promoter VUS, which they basically, even though it was formally assigned VUS by ACMG criteria, there was more of a VUS likely pathogenic based on the fact that the patient has such a compelling phenotype and in silico predictors were actually quite strong for suggesting that that promoter variant was going to be consequential from a functional standpoint. The female-to-male ratio was 3-1. All the childhood cases were girls, interestingly enough. All had, as you would expect, precapillary pulmonary hypertension with mean pulmonary arterial pressures in the range of 60 millimeters of mercury. 60% had airway anomalies, which included bronchial thickening, diverticula, mucoid impaction, cylindrical bronchiectasis. Parabronchial cysts were observed in nearly a third of patients, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon, I think. Parabronchial cysts, I don't think, are something one typically associates with pulmonary vascular disease, but nevertheless, I think that does prompt that consideration now in children, at least. Plexiform lesions, from a histopathologic standpoint, were identified in two-thirds of cases, as was peripheral fibrosis, lymphoid nodules, and parabronchial inflammation, basically small airways disease. 80% of these folks had skeletal anomalies, and this is owing to the fact that PBX4 plays a very critical role in skeletal development and in growth. Foot anomalies were kind of the big skeletal abnormality here. Mostly these really large gaps that develop between the first and second toes of a lot of these kids, and also had low arches or flat feet. Interestingly, phosphodiesterase or calcium blockade, phosphodiesterase administration or calcium blockade, which are typical mainstays for treating pulmonary arterial hypertension, did demonstrate some symptomatic improvements. So their NYHAs improved after receiving those therapies, but really their hemodynamics really didn't improve, so it doesn't really affect the underlying issues, and most of these patients will go on to require some type of transplant or something like that. So the take-home here is that TBX4 mutations basically confer an autosomal dominant condition, which is called the TBX4 syndrome, of which PAH is the most significant cause of morbidity and mortality in these patients. Incomplete penetrance can mess with how this looks from a heritability standpoint. And skeletal anomalies are very common in association with these. Again, I think the most interesting thing here is the radiologic findings of airway changes in these individuals as well, and that's probably in some way related to TBX4 in some way. But again, it can cause fibrosis and small airways disease and cystic disease, and so you can kind of expand your spectrum of diseases or expand your differential to include this syndrome when you see those things, particularly in constellation in a child. So kind of a cool paper there. One other paper that I'll just draw your attention to real quick.
Joe, can I just quickly ask, not really has anything to do with the paper, but I was wondering clinically, who gets testing now with pulmonary arterial hypertension? I mean, seeing all these mutations popping up.
Yeah, it's a great question. Given that the assays are still pretty nascent and our understanding of the genetics of pulmonary hypertension is equally nascent, there's not a lot of testing that's being done. Obviously, at some academic centers where this is an academic interest, people do go the extra mile and they do testing, which is frequently negative. Like I said, only about 15, in some studies, 20% of patients will have an uncovered mutation. It's mostly done for kindred tracking. And so if you identify a mutation, you can screen the first-degree relatives, and that can be a good indicator as to whether or not these people may develop late course of the disease. Because of the phenotypic variability with pulmonary arterial hypertension means that some of these patients develop the hemodynamic consequences of the disease at later periods of time. So just because you've got pulmonary arterial hypertension and your brother or sister is screened with an echo or with hemodynamic studies and shown to not have it, doesn't mean that they don't harbor the underlying genetics they might later develop it. And so being able to genetically screen these people is important. Unfortunately, we just don't know enough about the genetics now to uncover a majority of cases. Genomic odysseys and things like that, which are now certainly more mainstays in this area, I think are going to improve that. And so, you basically sample the individual who has pulmonary arterial hypertension as well as three of their relatives and do trio studies and compare those with the hemodynamics in each of those individuals. And that allows you to basically discover new potential genes that are involved in these things, kind of analogous to what they used to do with older type genetic studies. But nevertheless, it just depends. Most patients do not get this testing. The ones who are most primed to get it are kids and real young adults. the ones with truly idiopathic pulmonary arterial hypertension, but we're just not at a point where we're screening people enough, I think, which is kind of unfortunate.
I see. Thank you.
So the one other paper that I'll just bring up really quickly here in the last 4 minutes, not to kind of drop a giant stick of dynamite in the room and then walk away or anything, but Dr. Travis's review on recommendations for pathologic assessment of lung cancer resection, so the big IASLC multidisciplinary recommendations, was formally published last month in JCO. And so for those of you who haven't read it yet, this is something you'll need to read. This is something that's being recommended for all pathologists to do for lung cancer specimens. A lot of the recommendations are pretty straightforward and I think in line with standard practice for most pathologists. It really just codifies and formally recognizes those in the document. There are some things, however, that are going to be rather controversial, and those things are like assessing major pathologic response in percentage-based increments. So for those of you that really loved telling how much of something that was lipidic or acid or things, you're going to be in great stead. for everybody else, it's going to be a bit of a challenge to figure out, you know, what the percentage of viability in some of these things are. There are a lot of problems with inter-observer variability in that, which they kind of mention, but nevertheless recommend that that we're counting up how much of the tumor is seen in basically 10% increments, unless it's less than 10, unless it's less than 5, you don't report a single-digit score. There's all these complexities, of course, which is what I think is going to be the most controversial aspect of it. People are going to bristle at it. So aside from those, I think a lot of it is pretty straightforward, but it's going to make a splash, and we probably all should familiarize ourselves with what's in that document. So that's included in here as well. Any questions about that or thoughts, comments?
It really had been such a great journal club until just minutes ago.
On Saturday when I was putting some more of this together, I thought, you know, maybe this should be an article I discussed, and then I thought, you know, it's summer and 2020 has been a bad enough year. I really don't want to be pilloried like this. I'm not going to catch this one.
Thank you, guys. Good job,
Joe.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good day.
Thanks.